When he could escape from work, he took long walks with Laura in the fields far from the village, where men seldom came and only the robot cultivators disturbed the solitude. For hours, Laura would question him about Earth, but she would never speak of the planet that was the Magellan's goal. He understood her reasons well enough and did his best to satisfy her endless curiosity about the world that was already home to more men than had ever seen it with their own eyes. She was bitterly disappointed to hear that the Age of Cities had passed. Despite all that Leon could tell her about the completely decentralized culture that now covered the planet from pole to pole, she still thought of Earth in terms of such vanished giants as Chandragarh, London, Astrograd, New York, and it was hard for her to realize that they had gone forever, and with them the way of life they represented. When we left Earth, Leon explained, the largest centers of population were university towns like Oxford, or Ann Arbor, or Canberra. Some of them had 50,000 students and professors. There are no other cities left of even half that size. But what happened to them? Oh, there was no single cause. But the development of communication started it. As soon as anyone on Earth could see and talk to anyone else by pressing a button, most of the need for cities vanished. Then anti-gravity was invented, and you could move goods or houses or anything else through the sky without bothering about geography. That completed the job of wiping out distance, which the airplane had begun a couple of centuries earlier. After that, men started to live where they liked, and the cities dwindled away. For a moment, Laura did not answer. She was lying on a bank of grass, watching the behavior of a bee, whose ancestors, like hers, had been citizens of Earth. It was trying vainly to extract nectar from one of Thalassa's native flowers. Insect life had not yet arisen on this world, and the few indigenous flowers had not yet invented lures for airborne visitors. The frustrated bee gave up the hopeless task and buzzed angrily away. Laura hoped that it would have enough sense to head back to the orchards, where it would find more cooperative flowers. When she spoke again, it was to voice a dream that had now haunted mankind for almost 1,000 years. "Do you suppose," she said wistfully, "that we'll ever break through the speed of light?" Leon smiled, knowing where her thoughts were leading. To travel faster than light, to go home to Earth, yet to return to your native world while your friends were still alive? Every colonist must, at some time or other, have dreamed of this. There was no problem in the whole history of the human race that had called forth so much effort and that still remained so utterly intractable. "I don't believe so," he said. "If it could be done, someone would have discovered how by this time. No, we have to do it the slow way, because there isn't any other. That's how the universe is built, and there's nothing we can do about it."
"But surely we could still keep in touch."
Leon nodded. "That's true," he said, "and we try to. I don't know what's gone wrong, but you should have heard from Earth long before now. We've been sending our robot message carriers to all the colonies, carrying a full history of everything that's happened up to the time of departure, and asking for a report back. As the news returns to Earth, it's all transcribed and sent out again by the next messenger. So we have a kind of interstellar news service, with the Earth as the central clearinghouse. It's slow, of course, but there's no other way of doing it. If the last messenger to Thalassa has been lost, there must be another on the way, maybe several, 20 or 30 years apart." Laura tried to envisage the vast, star-spanning network of message carriers shuttling back and forth between Earth and its scattered children, and wondered why Thalassa had been overlooked. But with Leon beside her, it did not seem important. He was here. Earth and the stars were very far away. And so also, with whatever unhappiness it might bring, was tomorrow. By the end of the week, the visitors had built a squat and heavily braced pyramid of metal girders, housing some obscure mechanism on a rocky headland overlooking the sea. Laura, in common with the 571 other inhabitants of Palm Bay and the several thousand sightseers who had descended upon the village, was watching when the first test was made. No one was allowed to go within a quarter of a mile of the machine, a precaution that aroused a good deal of alarm among the more nervous islanders. Did the Earthmen know what they were doing? Suppose that something went wrong. And what were they doing anyway? Leon was there with his friends inside that metal pyramid, making the final adjustments. The course focusing, he had told Laura, leaving her none the wiser. She watched with the same anxious incomprehension as all her fellow islanders until the distant figures emerged from the machine and walked to the edge of the flat-topped rock on which it was built. There they stood, a tiny group of figures silhouetted against the ocean, staring out to sea. A mile from the shore, something strange was happening to the water. It seemed that a storm was brewing, but a storm that kept within an area only a few hundred yards across. Mountainous waves were building up, smashing against each other and then swiftly subsiding again. Within a few minutes, the ripples of the disturbance had reached the shore, but the center of the tiny storm showed no sign of movement. It was as if, Laura told herself, an invisible finger had reached down from the sky and was stirring the sea. Quite abruptly, the entire pattern changed. Now the waves were no longer battering against each other. They were marching in step, moving more and more swiftly in a tight circle. A cone of water was rising from the sea, becoming taller and thinner with every second. Already it was 100 feet high, and the sound of its birth was an angry roaring that filled the air and struck terror into the hearts of all who heard it. All, that is, except the little band of men who had summoned this monster from the deep, and who still stood watching it with calm assurance, ignoring the waves that were breaking almost against their feet. Now the spinning tower of water was climbing swiftly up the sky, piercing the clouds like an arrow as it headed towards space. Its foam-capped summit was already lost beyond sight. And from the sky there began to fall a steady shower of rain, the drops abnormally large, like those which prelude a thunderstorm. Not all the water that was being lifted from Thalassa's single ocean was reaching its distant goal. Some was escaping from the power that controlled it and was falling back from the edge of space. Slowly, the watching crowd drifted away, astonishment and fright already yielding to a calm acceptance. Man had been able to control gravity for 500,000 years, and this trick, spectacular though it was, could not be compared with the miracle of hurling a great starship from sun to sun at little short of the speed of light. The Earthmen were now walking back toward their machine, clearly satisfied with what they had done. Even at this distance, one could see that they were happy and relaxed, perhaps for the first time since they had reached Thalassa. The water to rebuild the Magellan's shield was on its way out into space, to be shaped and frozen by the other strange forces that these men had made their servants. In a few days, they would be ready to leave, their great interstellar ark as good as new. Even until this minute, Laura had hoped that they might fail. There was nothing left of that hope now, as she watched the man-made water spout lift its burden from the sea. Sometimes it wavered slightly, its base shifting back and forth as if at the balance point between immense and invisible forces. But it was fully under control, and it would do the task that had been set for it. That meant only one thing to her. Soon she must say goodbye to Leon. She walked slowly toward the distant group of Earthmen, marshaling her thoughts and trying to subdue her emotions. Presently, Leon broke away from his friends and came to meet her. Relief and happiness were written across his face, but they faded swiftly when he saw Laura's expression. "Well," he said lamely, almost like a schoolboy caught in some crime, "we've done it." "And now, how long will you be here?" He scuffed nervously at the sand, unable to meet her eye. "Oh, about 3 days, perhaps 4. She tried to assimilate the words calmly. After all, she had expected them. This was nothing new. But she failed completely. And it was as well that there was no one near them.
"You can't leave," she cried desperately. "Stay here on Thalassa."
Leon took her hands gently, then murmured, "No, Laura, this isn't my world. I would never fit into it. Half my life's been spent training for the work I'm doing now. I could never be happy here where there aren't any more frontiers. In a month, I should die of boredom."
"Then take me with you."
"You don't really mean that."
"But I do."
"You only think so. You'd be more out of place in my world than I would be in yours."
"I could learn. There would be plenty of things I could do as long as we could stay together."
He held her at arm's length, looking into her eyes. They mirrored sorrow and also sincerity. She really believed what she was saying, Leon told himself. For the first time, his conscience smote him. He had forgotten, or chosen not to remember, how much more serious these things could be to a woman than to a man. He had never intended to hurt Laura. He was very fond of her, and would remember her with affection all his life. Now he was discovering, as so many men before him had done, that it was not always easy to say goodbye. There was only one thing to do. Better a short, sharp pain than a long bitterness. "Come with me, Laura," he said. "I have something to show you."